Welcome back, as the IFC presents another episode of the Archetypes of Destiny. My name is James Malamus. We've got a great episode for you. Today we continue with our new series, The Four Archetypes. We will discuss the resolution of the glitch, part 3. It's a great discussion, we can't wait for you to hear it. If you enjoy the IFC's Archetypes of Destiny and want to support, make sure to rate the podcast 5 stars on iTunes and wherever you get your podcast. So without any further ado, Dr. El Samurai, take it away.
Welcome back to another episode of The Four Archetypes. I'm Dr. Wahab El Samurai, and with me today, Dr. Eric Tomlinson is here with us, and Whitman is here with us today. How you doing, Whit?
Good, thanks.
What's going on?
Oh, just looking forward to spring.
Yeah.
The journey of life is going on.
Yeah. So we're missing Dr. Lisa Hong today. We were missing Whit last week, but we will carry on. We will one day show up, all of us, as the four archetypes. But as of today, we're three. All right. So today we go back to our story. And this is part 3 of Jamp and the resolution of the glitch. So today we're going to take some ideas from the book and discuss them a little further. From chapter 8, 9, and 10, last week we went through 4, 5, 6, and 7, I think. So without further ado, let's get into the material. Okay. So from chapter 8, Dr. Eric, you had something that you wanted to share from chapter 8?
Yeah, but it's not directly related to what we're getting ready to read, though. Page 14.
Okay. Well, why don't we start with the quote, the Jungian quote. That starts us off on chapter that is on the top part of page 94.
Oh, 94, I'm sorry.
Everything that irritates us about others can lead us to understanding of ourselves. Pretty profound words by Carl Jung. Everything that irritates us about others leads to further understanding of ourselves. Very interesting, because what we're talking about is being able to see parts of your personality that you are not aware of through the reaction to other people's personalities. So yeah. Go ahead, Whit.
Oh, no, I just seems like kind of one of those mic drop quotes, you know?
Yeah.
it packs a punch.
It does pack a punch. And the punch that it packs is that awareness is a two-way street. It's not a one-way street. So when you become aware of others, you're also becoming aware of yourself. The more you're aware of what others are, what's irritating most about others is usually something that you're denying yourself.
Yeah, and that's what makes this quote so, as Whitman said, packs such a punch, because it's what we see in them, and oftentimes feel superior to them in some way or another. We think, what an ass to say something like that. Yet it's the same thing that we have felt many times before with other people. But when we see it, but we can't hate ourselves for it, or it's difficult to. So it's much easier to dislike someone else for being that way.
Ooh.
And project our own feelings as if that's not us at all. And That's why they irritate me so much, because I'm nothing like them. I mean, on and on and on with the statements.
Well,
let's
give some examples so people understand what we're talking about, what irritates us about other people. Let's give an example. So if somebody is outspoken and we've been told not to raise our voice, that will irritate us. So it's the part of me that I am preventing from expressing itself. So being outspoken. So anytime anybody is outspoken in front of me, I'm irritated by them. Like, I don't like them. I don't appreciate them. They think they know everything. So that's the reaction that comes with that, because that's a part of me that I am denying that exists, that is legitimate. So when it is evoked by another, so this could be like several different things. It could be being outspoken. Right. It could be, go ahead, Whit.
No, it seems to me that it could even lead to a level of like envy, for example. If you've been told to avoid something, it could irritate you out of envy, not just because you don't, you know, it's not like a disgusting smell or taste where you just say, oh, that's too much. It could also irritate you out of envy. You want that. It's not just, oh, that person's mean. They say rude things, or they're abrasive, you know, or something like that. It's
Maybe
you want to be abrasive more than you are, and or assertive. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's a good point. And sometimes that level of reaction within people can indicate that person is a little bit more open to talk about that what irritated them is a problem for them. Mm-hmm. And then there are those who would, of course, that are much more deeper into it, that would get very irritated at you suggesting that attitude or demonstration by that person could be something that resides within them. So it does show that there are different layers or different levels of the impact of this idea.
Young would talk about the inferior function. He would call it, this is your inferior function acting up. And the inferior function is basically the shadow, or what we're calling the unknown other, because it's a part of us that's not something that we let out in daylight or we are happy about or we promote. Or it comes out of us when we're being obnoxious or angry or feeling the complex. But otherwise, we don't want to be associated with it. So like anger, hate, envy, as Whit put it. All these things are things that we cannot tolerate about ourselves, because we're all good. The saying goes, hey, we're all good.
Would it be the same if his quote was, everything that we admire about others leads us to an understanding of ourselves?
No, that's something that you're conscious of. That's something you're connected to. That's something you're okay with.
But yes, it can be true. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, Eric?
Well, I mean, things that I see in others that I admire can very much be related to something that I either have a little bit of and want more of, or don't have much of and want more of.
Well, yeah, but it's something that you acknowledge about yourself.
Yeah, no,
something
no,
that you like, you like about yourself. No, in terms of the quote, what Jung is saying, what irritates us is stuff that is not in our consciousness.
No, I understand that.
Usually.
Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to
that's a good way to help other people understand. Frame this. So
yeah.
The unconscious. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the unconscious aspects of us. It's the parts of us that father said, that's not okay. Mother said, that's not okay. Society said, that's not okay. School said, it's not okay.
School, the teachers.
The teachers said, it's not okay. Your friends said, it's not okay. Don't do that. So whoever had influence over you, whoever told you it's not okay. So that gets stored with the stuff. It's like, okay, that's not okay. Therefore, that's not who I am. And when we start telling ourselves stories of who I am, there are things about me that I cannot acknowledge because I've been told they're not okay. Therefore, those things go into the unknown other. It goes away. I don't hold it in my ego. My ego says those are banished. I am banishing them. But the ego always has a partner. That is the unknown other, the shadow. Mm-hmm. The ego always has a connection, what Jung calls the shadow. It's always there. So whatever the ego can't tolerate about self, you know, you're a know-it-all. Right, I didn't even know that was an insult. I thought they were acknowledging me. No, seriously, I didn't know like know it all meant like.
Thank you.
I was like, yeah, thanks, I appreciate it. You know? So that I take to heart, that I acknowledge, that I feel good about. What about like you're stupid? Okay, so that would not be something that I would acknowledge. I can't be stupid. So, but anybody can be stupid about something. Everybody can make a mistake about something. Everybody can take a wrong turn about something. So what about that? How do I manage that part of me? Do I say it doesn't exist? Well, this is the problem, right? Of course it exists. So everything that exists within the other person exists within me. Lust, love, ambition, hate, anger, peace, chaos. These are all things, qualities that we share as a group, as an organism.
What you just said ties back into something that I had underlined earlier in the chapter I'd like to read.
Yeah.
It ties right into it.
Yeah, go for it.
There are times that there are times when it would be best to breathe through your trigger and not address someone who seems unstable and / irritable / whatever term you want to put in there. Moreover, this would be classified as desensitization. And yeah, it fits in with the old systematic desensitization steps that certain treatments give to people who have phobias, for example.
Yeah.
And I know that when I try to apply this statement to me when I'm triggered by someone or something, it doesn't have to be triggered by someone. It can be something, some thought in my own mind that is not true, but I've learned to believe. I have to address the trigger in some way, or I'm just going to either continue doing it, or I'm going to ruminate on it. So I thought that the idea of use something helpful when you're triggered was a really, really important point that this chapter made.
Ooh. So we trigger, these triggers are also depending on how much of those things that we deny being were not traumas. We weren't traumatized. We weren't told that we were good for nothing and we were beaten. That would pertain to a trauma, feeling not good enough, not being able to hold one's own, seeing oneself less than other people, and actually being triggered by things that are positive things, like speaking up for yourself, like standing up for yourself, like feeling that you have a right.
Mm-hmm.
Why does he feel like he has a right to do that? Nobody has a right to do that. And that's interesting, right? So we also watch our language, because our language betrays our feeling state. So the things that you say about a subject says more about you than the actual subject. Always. And it's our feeling state. Our feeling state has its own language. Oh, they think they're so special. They know shit. I know when I say that. That's envy. I can feel it. I can feel the envy. Right? So the more conscious we are of ourselves, the easier it is to live with self. No, I'm never like that. No, that's impossible. They're talking about somebody else. That makes it more difficult to live with myself. We have to be able to see our cracks and not be afraid of them, scared of them. That's why we look for those things that reinforce our belief in ourselves. We're a constant search for those. But the denial of the other things is problematic. The denial of aspects of yourself is like cutting pieces of yourself off and tossing them away, saying they don't exist. Yeah, Whit.
So let's provide an example, because I think for sure. Folks like myself, we might be in over our head when we're kind of, when we hear you mentioning that. So let's say
you're in a program, you and two other students, and the other two students actually stand up for themselves and you don't.
Okay.
You feel it's disrespectful and rude because you've been taught it's disrespectful and rude to talk back. So that has taught you not to stand up for yourself. So when you see them doing that, you think of them as being rude. Oh, how rude. I would never do that. That's not who I am. That's not how I was raised. Now you're defining yourself by concept and ideas. So you have twisted yourself into a bundle and put yourself in one of those glasses. Have you seen those glasses that twirl? So you've twirled yourself into this glass. Now you have to pop yourself out. Because basically you have put these borders around you, these containers to hold you in certain ways, in certain aspects, and you can't free yourself of them. Now, they might be being rude. They're not standing up for themselves. That might be the case. But not being able to stand for one's own and believing that it's disrespectful to acknowledge something that is not representative of you becomes an issue. So now there's this barrier that you carry with yourself. There are things that you do not permit yourself to do or think because they're not acceptable. And so what happens is it's like a hammer. Every time I want to like, oh, that's not your place. I've heard this too. What is it? Stay in your lane. Whatever the fuck that means. I don't know. Is there an invisible lane that I'm supposed to be occupying? And then I like inadvertently moved out of my invisible lane into some other lane. I was like, what is that? What does that mean exactly? But it's interesting. I mean, the way that other people see us is a reflection of the way we see, we don't. We see ourselves very differently than other people who talk about us. Right? So we activate, what's activated is always the projection, right? I don't see you. I see the idea of Whitman. What is the idea that I have of Whitman? What is the idea I have of Eric? What is the idea I have of Lahab? What is the idea? So within that frame, that's the person I talk to. Now, what happens when that person surprises me and says, what the fuck are you talking about? Then I have to like say, yeah, what am I talking about? That's not who I'm talking to. That's just a projection. That's my projection. So it's always good. So von Franz has this book called Projection and Recollection. It's a brilliant book. If you ever have a chance, please read it. Mary Louise von Franz. But anyway, in the book, she talks about the idea of the projection, why the projection is necessary. So if you're building a relationship, for instance, you're in love, the projections are what you are connecting you to the other person. So those projections are required. But for the love to flourish and change and become a relationship, not just the projection, become real, you start to become more real because the relationship requires it. You can't have a relationship based on projection. You need to recall those projections to be able to be in the relationship. Because you can't hold the projections. You can only hold them for so long. It's like, oh, you're getting old. I saw you much younger than that. You can only hold them for so long. They tatter and fall. Right? Because it's an idea. It's a projected idea. Well, what is a projection? Projection is my idea out in the world of ideas. So they're objects. I see them in certain ways, and I relate to them in those ways. When I start relating to another person, not through the projection, I start relating to the person at a more profound level. Because now the projection is not interfering with my feeling state for this person. So there's a connection. There's a deeper underlying connection in the relationship. I see them for what they are, but I accept them for what they are. I no longer need to hold them under the light, in the glitter, to feel good about them. Now I can see them in the darkness. Now I can see them with their flaws. Now I can see them with their fears. Now I can see them with their hiccups. Now I can see them with their anger, their rage, their pain. Now I can see them as human. Mm-hmm. That does not start that way. The relationship does not start that way. It cannot start that way. Why? Because it's boring. Yeah, it's boring. It's like, okay, well, I need to project something to hold on to. So it's like throwing out a net, the projection. Mm-hmm. Now, what you hope is that you get treasure. You don't end up with like garbage, right? Within the projection. But that's basically the projection. So idea of the projection, not to get too.
And what's interesting to me about that is that sometimes your net, especially in the early years of a relationship, can catch, can reel in and catch their projections of you and not the way they really view you. And that makes it interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's everybody's projecting, right?
Yeah.
So everybody's throwing a net. Everybody's catching something different. You think you that what you're giving in the net is different from what they're getting. But it's not. It's completely different. What they get is completely different because it's a projection. It's personal. It's my construct. Today I was reading about the AI, about a letter that Elon Musk, Wozniak, and a bunch of others wrote, asking them to have basically a hold on period for AI before introducing more, before they create chaos. To create some parameters for AI. Basically, you're not creating any parameters for AI. You're just letting it run amok, which can be very destructive, because what basically what it is there is what these chatbots do is they go through the web and they pick up patterns. The web has all kinds of stupid patterns that are destructive, that don't need to be mimicked or recalled or recreated. What is so they're basically picking up patterns, and therefore, because they pick up patterns over and over again, they could start to put some rational thoughts, ideas, essays, poems together through using those patterns. But they don't pick up one pattern, they pick up thousands and thousands of patterns. Now the problem is that the patterns they're creating can be made up of more problematic patterns. So they could recreate that and create chaos. What does that mean? Well, there's a lot of racist language on the web. There's a lot of misinformation on the web. There's a lot of people made up shit on the web. There's a lot of stories on the web that don't connect to reality. The chatbot doesn't know reality. The chatbot doesn't know right from wrong. The chatbot knows patterns. It's fascinating, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, they're learning like little kids, the chatbots. Whatever they hear, they're mimicking. So we think when the kid says something interesting, we're all like, oh, they're so smart. Listen to them. Where did they come up with that? So now we're attributing consciousness to them. They don't have a consciousness. They work off a reservoir. The problem with the reservoir is that our projections onto the reservoir is the problem. It's the way we see the information they're giving us is the problem. Because we're just taking it as fact. Like, oh yeah, we created this monster and this monster just produces for me. So, just a projection and recollection. So now we projected all of our ideas, our fears, our inspiration, our hopes onto programs that study patterns. Basically, we basically are mimicking our own consciousness.
Shall we move to chapter 9?
Yeah, yeah.
Or
do you want to start us off in chapter 9?
What do you think?
Yeah. Generational trauma, I think you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, it's the, well, you, chapter 9 is the tribe illusion.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So we have a subsection, Family Matters. And the last paragraph in Family Matters before generational trauma, I think it sets it up pretty well to go into generational trauma. So,
okay.
Mind if I read a paragraph or is that?
No, go for it. This is page 101.
101.
Yeah, go for it.
So, starts here. Now, this tribe illusion is not one that was imposed on you and you alone. Most of the time, the tribe illusion has been handed down from one generation to another, and previous generations feel as though they turned out fine and so continue to perpetuate this cycle of generational trauma. There's also the misconception among some generations that as long as a child hasn't been hit, no abuse occurred. However, neglect, yelling, fighting, emotional manipulation, asking the child to take on a parental role, playful teasing, and narcissistic tendencies, among many others, can be deemed as abusive and can cause trauma. Whether these things were intentional or not is irrelevant. Remember, you cannot rectify anything in those that traumatized you. You cannot expect them to change or to acknowledge their faults. That is their journey, which you cannot control. What you can do is recognize generational trauma and divert this energy that keeps you from entering a positive upward spiral. And then it, you know, so then generational trauma.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Well,
what are your thoughts?
You know, unless I'd like to think I don't live under a rock, and I try to keep my ear to the ground. Is it? Don't they say that? Isn't that the saying? I don't know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, I like to talk about like big, you know, big culture kind of things in the, and well, at least things in that kind of term, American culture. I think it's been absent a lot of discussions. And I think part of that is our delayed understanding of just mental health, or ooh, our delayed public awareness of it.
Yeah.
I think it also has to do with, you know, class and race, and generational trauma just has not been discussed very much in certain parts of American life. And so that's what I, and that's kind of my experience, which may tell you something. But it's incredibly important because we have a lot of wide or large scale generational trauma in this country. And it's not just parts of the world that have been conflict ridden for, yeah, I mean, generations and generations.
Absolutely.
I've experienced it and seen it, what those things can, how it can manifest, I don't know if manifest is the right word in this in this context, but with YouTube.
Yeah, manifest would be. Yeah.
But yeah, so I feel that I've seen this manifest in different ways. What do you owe to your parents, for example? Yeah. Other cultures, this is huge.
Yeah.
It is a lot, I think, a source for shame if you are not in touch enough with what you can and what you are doing for your parents.
Yeah.
Especially as they get older.
Yeah.
But also
the invisible pain you carry for them, the pain they carry for others, right, that they don't know they carry, that's the pain that you end up carrying. The loss of a mother, the loss of a father, the loss of a brother or a sister, an early childhood trauma, sexual trauma, physical trauma, an emotional, psychological trauma. Those things that they carry with them that they don't speak about, they tell you this. They say, I don't talk about that. We don't talk about that. We don't mention that. We try to not open that subject. And that part, that's the part that they carry, that they carry, you carry. Because what they're doing is what their behavior in the house, the behavior in the home, the behavior around you. Okay, so this is your environment. So the behavior around you is there's always an avoidance of a topic that's too sensitive or problematic. So now you carry that avoidance. And you carry avoidance of like topics that are too complicated for you too. But you don't know where you got that. And that's a glitch. But you don't know how you got that glitch, because it's like, well, I mean, my parents didn't say don't do that or do this. But their unspoken words was, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how.
Yeah.
It's passed on.
Sure.
Right. It's like, oh, we don't do that. Okay, why? I don't understand. Okay. Like we're not happy. We don't show happiness, because then people will say that why are they acting stupid? Like happiness is stupid. Which is strange. Well, my mother used to say when we laugh too much, she's like, "Oh, I hope something bad doesn't happen." Like we've used up all the energy of happiness, and now only disaster can come up. But that's intergenerational trauma. That's the fear of something bad happening or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that fear is always present. So now it's intruding onto the happier moments that you have. Even though when we're kids, we look at mom and like, what the hell is she talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Is this crazy? Right. Yeah. But we internalize that. She's our mom. So we internalize it. We don't even think about it anymore. We take it on.
You say in the book, who is at risk of generational trauma? I mean, I'm guessing
everyone.
There's, yeah. But what you do list, or what is listed, anyone whose ancestors experienced war, natural disasters, widespread racism and segregation, and catastrophes of any kind, anyone with parents who were abused, anyone who grew up in a home with substance abusers, anyone raised with harsh discipline, which was incorrectly seen as the norm for their parents' generation, seems a little specific.
Mm.
Anyone who was abandoned and who moved through the foster system.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, those are parent, right? Those are like clear. You know how that develops, and how that over time, not having somebody, not having parents, for example, being in the foster system, not being wanted. Okay, so a major organism issue, you need to be wanted. You need to feel like you belong to the collective. When you're in the foster care system, it's like you're outside the collective.
Yeah.
And that could breed all kinds of traumas.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Being unwanted.
That's a, you know, an interesting kind of example to think about, because there's like a disconnect with your tribe in a way.
Mm.
Because you're not in touch with what, I mean, they say trauma is, it affects your DNA. I mean, you.
Correct. It changes your DNA.
So you are experiencing almost like a second layer through, yeah, the actual foster system. And you're also not in touch with what you're potentially, what, receiving or have received from, you know, your parents, your biological parents.
Well, when you're in the foster system, you're basically, you're dumped. So the first feeling you get is like, nobody gives a shit about me. They're just going to dump me somewhere. You know, they even have like plastic bags that they take from place to place. There's a kind of, there's a real traumatic event, which is, and usually you end up in foster care. Why? Because your parents are not able to take care of you. They didn't want you. They didn't survive. You don't have anybody else to care for you. And so you end up in a system that basically hands you off to people who get paid to care for you. Now, depending on your luck, there are decent people out there who, and there are people who just want to get paid. They don't care. Mm-hmm. You're traumatized or not. That's not their, that, yeah, that hasn't been my experience. I worked in with families who took a lot of kids in who were very disturbed. And my,
the families were disturbed or the kids were disturbed?
No, the kids came from disturbed families and they were disturbed themselves by the trauma.
Okay.
And but these foster parents were amazing. I mean, they put up with a lot. It wasn't about the money. The money was ridiculously low. And they carried a lot of the pain that these kids, and they become victims of the kids because the kids are victims of others. So anybody who cares for these kids end up being victimized by them, because that's how trauma works its way through when it's not treated. You basically, it victimizes you, and then you start to victimize others because you're, it just has basically ate you up and spat you out.
Yeah, it sounds like to me that's kind of carrying on, perpetrating something that was committed against you.
Absolutely.
Or is this different?
No, it very likely. It's
a reaction to a, yeah, it's a reaction.
Very likely that something was done to you, and the way you have interpreted the pain. So that pain can be interpreted in different ways. One was like, I don't want to ever feel this again, and I don't want anybody else to feel like this ever again. Or, why am I always in pain? I hope the whole world feels my pain.
Hmm.
And both of them are fair statements, by the way. They are. It's your pain. You have a right to have a feeling state about your pain and how it's affecting you. Right. It's very difficult not to be part of the tribe, as we know. We need the tribe. The tribe cares for us, but it also blinds us to a lot of other things.
And you say that as well. I think there's a, I don't have my finger on it right this minute, but there's a paragraph where there's a,
yeah,
I think, you know, you
it holds us back.
describe you visit your family, it's re-energizing,
yeah,
it's positive, and then at the same time you feel like you've been taxed again, or
it is a tax
simultaneously, I guess,
because they haven't worked through their shit. So even if you have, even if you have had treatment, you're dealing with people who haven't had treatment. So that's a lot of, and especially when you're conscious of it, when you're conscious of the trauma now, and you're walking around, you're looking at it, and you're like, this is, how long do we have to keep watching this?
Yeah. And it will be a blessing. I mean, if they are curious about how you've dealt with it, that will be an ideal situation. If a family takes interest, oh, we'd love to know what, like, that was like for you. I mean, a lot of people are not gonna, they see their families for a holidays throughout the year. They don't have time for this. There's so many emotions swirling around, maybe.
Healing is complicated. Healing is complicated because... Go on, Nick.
I was just going to say, and we're a very individualistic society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But healing is complicated in terms of how do we feel about the other who's not? That's complicated. I mean, people who work hard on healing their pain, it's difficult for them to sit there and watch other people kind of still roll in their shit. It's very difficult. So especially if you're going back to family gatherings and you're watching the same dynamics, the same disturbing patterns that you've witnessed over and over again that have not been broken, are reinforced, and now a younger generation is walking around mimicking what the older generation has done. So the tribe is problematic. Yet we need the tribe. We need to be a part of the tribe. That's just how this organism, the human organism, is built.
Right.
We've survived because of the tribe. We have not survived because of just ourselves. We have survived within the tribe. It's always better with numbers. This is a thought that we have always. It's deep within the primal brain, right? The oldest part of the brain, the lizard brain. It's better within numbers. You're safer within numbers. You're safer in the middle of the group than outside of the group. And so there are feeling states that we have in regards to being part of the group. We're always searching to be a part of a group. And think about it, from like the time you go to kindergarten to the time you retire to the time you age, you're part of a group. First, you're part of the kids group. Then you're young adult. Then you're midlife. Then you're old. Then you're really old. Then you're really, really... Anyway, you're always part of a group. This is how we quantify, classify, and characterize our existence. We characterize it in the way that we move in time with this group. So we call them peers. We have names for the groups.
Right.
Colleagues, friends, associates.
Elders.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a big one. I think it's really interesting too. That's
well, this is when groups can promote healing. when groups of people decide that it's not okay to live in pain, as you said earlier, Whit, when we start acknowledging mental health in a different way, when we start acknowledging our own limitations as groups, and that we need help to feel better as a group, to think more clearly, to connect in a better way. And I think this is the journey of healing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, that's what Jungian advanced motor processing is about. That's what JAMP is about. It's about the journey of healing. It's finding a way to unlock the barriers that keep us from changing, that keep us from moving into the future, that keep us, that hold us back from how we feel towards life. Because if we're always thinking of pain and we're always struggling with pain, we forget that living is fun.
Right.
Right.
And it's got to do something to your nervous system, you know, I mean, to be sort of, you know, if you're conscious of certain things and you're, you know, you're unconscious of others, it's probably, I mean, it's got to do something to your nervous system to be caught, you know, or what's the word that you used in the
glitch?
Yeah. Not the glitch, but I feel like there's another one that you use. Anyways.
Well, your nervous system
not a,
is
not a cage, but like, you know,
psychic prison.
Yeah. So your nervous system is probably, you know, fighting, like you're
always overactive.
Your internal engine is probably revving.
Yeah.
And yet you're kind of in a standstill. Yeah.
Just to prove that point on a neuroscientific level, kids who have been abused, lots of studies have shown this, kids who have been abused persistently over their early years of life, not singular events, but persistently over time, many of them, by the time they're teenagers, have resting heart rates that are on an average of about 10 beats per minute faster than the typical person who has not gone through that. So the changes in their central nervous system has actually been cemented to some degree in them, and they're in a hyper state. They're hyper aroused. And trauma, persistent trauma, does that to us. It hyper arouses us.
Right.
To the point that even when we're relaxed, we're sitting in a chair, calm, listening to somebody, we're still hyper aroused.
Right.
Yeah. Hyper arousal ends up. Sorry, Whit.
No. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that the hyper arousal state, what it does is basically it forces you to be in physical discomfort, and also to have your physical state disrupted for so long that you start to prematurely age, that your internal organs start to have problems, that you end up having all kinds of pain and negative effects of that effect, that because your nervous system is so overactive.
That is significant, you know.
And the majority of those effects show up in two different areas. One is it's in something called the HPA axis and hypothalamus, pituitary, and adrenal glands. And so all of those interact as a result of this trauma. And so a person winds up having a greater risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a greater risk of breathing
attacks,
problems,
aneurysms.
I mean, it's just, and it also affects our immune system.
Absolutely.
So therefore, we wind up having an immune system that either is
compromised.
That can even start. Yeah, it is compromised. It can even start attacking ourselves and create, I think Lahab mentions it in one of these chapters about autoimmune effects.
Well, yeah, I mean, because your level of agitation, your nervous system is so agitated that it basically, your immune system is fighting that agitation. After a while, you will trigger it to think of what is attacking your immune system is something foreign. And so you will have a massive immune response to it. But that's because of prolonged exposure to the effects of your nervous system, way too overactive for such a long period of time that your body doesn't respond to the signals anymore. It basically has gone haywire.
Yeah.
And so it's attacking itself.
Yeah, it really is. I like the word you used. It really is compromised.
Yeah, it attacks itself. So it's like, okay, well, at first, you know, think of it this way. But at first, you're fighting shadows in your own house. After a while, those shadows that you're fighting, you start hitting the wall, you start falling on the table, you start wrestling with the refrigerator. After a while, it becomes real. Your house becomes unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, but this goes back to our beginning point, which is projection and recollection. The projection of the trauma is internalized. So the external trauma is projected internally. That's the dissociative aspect of it.
Hmm.
I saw it on the outside. There's an imprint on the inside, but it's incomplete.
Yeah, it's a wild stuff, but
yeah. So today, I think we got really heavy duty.
Yeah, but it was good.
Yeah. What are your thoughts today?
I think it's great. We're still recording. It's good. I enjoy the subject matter.
Just in a general educational thought behind it all, it just shows how much there is to us, to how we feel, how we think about it, how we feel about others, how we think about others. And yet, where are we taught about this in school? Where are the classes in college that I had that really got into the deep nature of this?
Yeah.
And yet the majority of our life is spent around other people, and 100% of our life is spent with ourselves, and we're not prepared to answer these questions. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. We spend more time studying for a driver's license test.
That's not enough. Yeah,
I don't think people understand that there are solutions and resolution to, and there's a treatment for it. I really think that people have a perception that you just end up talking about it, that you can't get relief from it. And
yeah,
that's
good
the
point.
Perception that we need to change.
Mm-hmm.
That is actual, there's actual treatment for it that relieves the symptoms of it, that you actually can get better, not stay in that state. And I think a lot of people think, oh,
stuck.
You know, I've been in therapy and I still have those issues.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, but there is a treatment. And that's why we talk about Jungian advanced motor processing, because there is a treatment for it. There's a treatment for the triggers. There's treatment for the anxiety. There's a treatment for what Dr. Eric described, which is the 10 extra heartbeats. There's a treatment for it. You don't have to be rattled all the time.
Right. And we're not at the place, too, as a society where, you know, I mean, we're talking about anxiety and depression more. Anxiety and depression is mentioned more, I think, to like on a larger scale media presence than, you know, probably during the 1920s when, you know, other things were going on, because there's been other periods of high conflict and so forth. But like, we're not saying, oh, you know, anxiety, you know, most likely caused by, you know, this really sensitive like part about your family, for example.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, a family generational trauma. We're, you know, it's technology, it's social media, it's, you know, but it's not like the stuff that people are like, yeah, understandably worried to talk about, you know. It's not like, hey, by the way, if you're experiencing this, it might actually be from, you know, something to do with generational trauma, for example, you know.
Well, it's terrifying to think, you know, when people start talking about their issues, they're like, oh, am I crazy? So, but those terms, yeah, they're extreme.
Yeah.
You know, crazy is a brief state in time. You cannot continue to be crazy. That's not how it works. Just to let you know. Even if you're schizophrenic, being hallucinating or is a brief phase of time. If you're getting treatment, if you're not getting treatment, of course, it can take a different course. But it's not crazy to find help. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Well, gentlemen.
So what do you do? Do you edit kind of our debrief
out? We didn't record that. Well, gentlemen, always a pleasure to see you on the four archetypes. Okay, as we always, or as we used to call it, we are the four archetypes, and we are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
We are not afraid.
So we will be back next week, and we will continue this conversation. We will do part four of JAMP and the resolution of the glitch. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to part three of the resolution of the glitch. We hope you enjoyed hearing from Dr. Al Samurai, Dr. Eric Tomlinson, and Whitman Davis. You can also find us on the IFC's YouTube. Make sure to check out the JAMP Institute for Training's Magician's Call podcast as well. The IFC is a not-for-profit institution. We do not have any paid advertising for our podcast, but we do accept donations. All donations and contributions are tax-deductible. You can find more info at theinstituteforconflict.com.